Welcome back, 99 Pages. It's Rajiv here with a very special episode. You know, I read 50 to 70 books a year, and I do so with a sincere desire to be impressed upon. And I'll say that no book or series of books have made a longer-lasting impression on me, giving me more blessings, more life, and more health than the works of Dr. Michael Greger. He is the author of How Not to Die, How Not to Diet, and the founder of NutritionFacts.org. He's out now with a beautiful new book called How Not to Age. Aging is something that I think about quite frequently. I want to be highly present with my kids, my grandkids, and maybe even meet a few great-grandchildren one day. But having 100 years to live doesn't happen randomly. Genetics may load the gun, but it is our behaviors which pull the triggers. Now, after my chat with Dr. Greger, you're also going to hear an interview I did with Mr. Roy Langdell. Roy is in his 90s. He's my next-door neighbor here in Vermont and my personal hero. He is a role model reminding me constantly of what it means to have a life well-lived. And I'll ask him about what it took to age with such grace and happiness. If you enjoy today's special episode, and I think you will, please consider sharing us with your family and friends and having a robust discussion of what it means to age gracefully. Also, you can join our email list at 99pages.club, where I send out book reviews and latest podcast episodes just twice monthly. Thanks, and please enjoy this very special episode of 99 Pages.
I have lost 35 pounds on a plant-based whole food diet.
Nice.
I am running regularly 30 miles a week, and I'm in the best health, and I am 7 to 10 years younger today than I was in my, you know, when I turned 30, and I'm 37. I feel in better shape. Every year that I incorporate the work from How Not to Die, How Not to Diet, and now How Not to Age, like, what? It's so easy. It's not even that bad.
That's what it's all about, but you never know how good you're going to feel till you give it a try.
Till you put it to the test.
That's right.
Right.
Personally put it to the test. Exactly.
Oh, man. How have you been? How's morale?
Things are great. We're talking less than a week to launch as we record this. Very excited.
I'm so proud of you.
Been many years putting this puppy together.
I mean, 13,000 citations.
Insane. I mean, yeah, it's more than, yeah. In fact, I just got the books. I had to print it on like tissue paper, you know, to like, you know, to squeeze the book down. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I mean, so 13,000 citations. I've never seen a book like for the mass market with that many citations. I think it's a really interesting place for us to start this interview in many ways, because when I think about the value proposition of nutritionfacts.org, of your research, it's like you were using double blind, placebo, peer reviewed research, typically academic studies, definitely not studies sponsored by industry. So when you say 13,000 citations, can you give our listeners like a framework? Like, what does that actually mean? And why do you do that?
Well, I mean, this is, reminds me, writing this book reminds me a lot about writing the last book on weight loss, right? How Not to Die. You know, both the diet and anti-aging industries are these multi-billion dollar behemoths, right? And with so much money in the mix, the temptation to promote, you know, products purporting all sorts of, you know, preposterous claims just seems kind of irresistible, right? Even a, you know, educated layperson would, you know, have difficulty, seeking just basic practical advice in either arena, living lighter or living longer, because they're just faced by an inscrutable barrage of potions and pills, right? Even as a physician, right, with the luxury of wading neck deep in the medical literature, right? I mean, it's been a challenge for me to tease out, you know, the naked truth from the, you know, emperor's garb, right? And so that just makes the endeavor that much more important, though. I mean, if it took me 3 years to sift through all the science, right, I'm afraid the casual observer would just kind of have no chance at separating, you know, facts from farce. And so, I mean, I really, it's like, I want to do the work so no one else has to. And many of these are basic fundamental questions that I personally want to know the answer to. I mean, the reason I started nutritionfacts.org is this is the website I wish I had when I was in medical school, because, you know, a patient would be like, should I take a multivitamin or not?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, you'd think that'd be an easy question to answer. But there's all sorts of, you know, corrupting commercial influences. You know, the multivitamin study is published, funded by a multivitamin, you know, manufacturer. You wonder, right? So, you know, we just wanted, look, I just, well, just give me the truth. Just cut, you know, cut out all the commercial BS and just lay it out for me. And so, after, you know, taking on the diet industry and oh my God, all the nutritional noise and nonsense there, the next was the, you know, the anti-aging field where it's just, there's, you know, so much money in the mix. That people are just, you know, it's so confusing. Basic questions. Should I take this supplement? Should I not take this supplement? You know. So the reason that the book just got so monstrous is that there's just so much to go over, right? I wanted to go through every aging pathway. Right? So that's the first part of the book. I wanted to, you know, go through all the blue zones, find out what in kind of the real world scenarios people are, how people are eating and living. Then I wanted to go through every single organ system, preserving your... you know, your, you know, hearing, your vision, your, you know, sex life, all down the, you know. And so that's, you know, that's what, another dozen chapters there. And so I just wanted to hit every possible, every single supplement that anyone's ever heard of or drug that people are taking for longevity. Well, let's go to the pros and cons of each of them. I'm not saying take this, don't take this. I'm saying here's the risks and benefits and it's your body, your choice. Do whatever you want.
That's the key. It's not about ordering you to do one thing or another. It's about at least the facts are on the table. One thing that I wanted to spend some time doing here, like what I think is really interesting is it's not really that people die of old age. They're still dying from disease,
yeah.
But the aging, if you will, exacerbates the let's say mortality rates of these diseases. Can we take a minute and just define aging? Like what exactly are we talking about?
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah, so yeah, there's no such thing as dying from old age. Based on a study of 14,000 consecutive autopsies, all centenarians, 100%, even those who looked perfectly fine, physicians said they were in good health. When they actually did autopsies, in 100% of the cases, they died of disease. Most often heart disease, which is what most men and women die of. And so, you know, wait a second, if people die from disease, why wasn't my book, How Not to Die, longevity book enough? Like, what else do you need?
You already answered the question.
Well, you know, because I just go through 15 leading causes of death, talk about their old diet, maybe playing each, you know, in preventing, arresting, reversing each of them. But then, you know, my realization with this new book is that, you know, as you said, aging is a primary risk factor for many of our leading killers, from heart disease and cancers and dementia, et cetera. And so, for example, even if we cured cancer, right, which would be like the greatest thing we ever saw in our lifetime, the average life expectancy would only go up 3 years. And the reason is because if you don't die from one age-related disease, well, you just drop dead of a heart attack, something else, right? If cancer doesn't get you, another one will. So if we slow down the aging process, then... you know, we can reduce the risk of all of these diseases across the board instead of kind of playing whack-a-mole. So that was really, you know, what I was aiming at going in here, talking about both lifespan, talking about health span, and what we can do to kind of slow the sands of time.
So is it that aging, like, is it that our, I guess, how do we describe what happens when an organ or when bones get older, right? Is it just physical deterioration? Is it a chemical change? Like what's actually going on under the surface level of like, oh, it's just getting older.
Right. Well, so there's 11 pathways of aging, which I go through each in the book, talk about the kind of diet and lifestyle approaches, kind of practical tips on what we can do to slow or block them. And so there's a bunch of things going on. Inflammation plays a role. There's some called inflammaging. We have increased inflammatory markers as we get older. Something called cellular senescence, where our cells stop replicating and start spewing out these inflammatory compounds. We have something called the decline in autophagy, which is kind of the house cleaning system our body has to get rid of kind of accumulated cellular debris that contributes to the aging process. There's a mitochondrial theory of aging, talking about the accumulation of DNA damage from free radical assaults. Then there's enzymes that pro-aging enzymes actually speed up aging. Then there's anti-aging enzymes and hormones. And so it typically is the accumulation of irreversible damage. And so if it's irreversible, then the ideal thing is to prevent that accumulation of damage in the first place, or at least slow down the accumulation of damage. But, you know, what's remarkable is that, and so we think, well, maybe it's just kind of natural, inevitable process that entropy, it's just like, it's going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it.
Right.
But no, if you think about it, every egg in every ovary on the planet basically erases its age down to zero before it's fertilized. Otherwise, you know, that 20-year-old woman that gets pregnant would have a 20-year-old egg. And then their daughter would have a 40-year-old egg. And then so we would have cells that are millions of years old by now. And that doesn't happen.
That doesn't make sense.
And so what the body actually does is erases all signs of aging in our gametes, in the egg cells. And so basically women are born with every egg cell they're ever gonna have. Men keep making sperm all the time, but women are one and done. And so those eggs are at least puberty age by the time they're fertilized, yet they start at zero. And so that shows that aging in cells is reversible. So it isn't irreversible damage, it is reversible. And so how can we take advantage of the body's own mechanisms to reverse aging in cells? To do that with so-called somatic cells or cells of the body, not just our gametes.
You know, that's so fascinating because, I just kind of did some offhand interviews with folks to see when you think about aging, what comes to mind? And I had someone tell me, it's like, you know, doesn't the body's cells effectively reproduce? You become effectively a new person every 7 years. That's about how long it takes for your every organ in your body to like reproduce cells. It's like, cellularly speaking, you are just not physically the same matter as you were 7 years ago, yet you're fundamentally different. And the offspring of each cell propagates damage, propagates problems. Like that to him was what aging was. And to put it in almost a reverse context of like the ovary erases aging. That's
amazing.
Super cool.
Absolutely down to zero. And if you think about it, you know, but I like that concept talking about, and different tissues have different turnover rates. So the outer layer of your skin, actually can turn over, you know, in a month. Some like the crystalline proteins in our lenses that are transparent, in our lifetime, don't get turned over.
Wow.
Collagen is also very slow. But yeah, but in general, like, you know, every year, every few years, basically who you're looking at is your different matter. And so then it's like, well, wait a second. That gives new meaning to the term you are what you eat. Because you are physically what you eat. I mean, your body is made up of what? Water, air, sunlight, food, right? So wait a second. If you're brand new 7 years from now, where does that you come from?
Yeah.
And so if you're building something, you want to use shoddy building materials? You want to build your body out of just the worst crap out of there?
Yeah.
Well, no wonder why what you eat makes such a difference, because that really literally is building you every second of every day.
And boy, oh boy, about 2 years ago when I started, before I actually started this plant-based diet, I probably was made out of bacon. I mean, and I kind of looked the part, if I can be completely honest. And now I'm made out of kale and red cabbage.
All right.
So when I interviewed my friends about aging, the number one thing I heard was muscle mass and preventing muscle mass loss.
Yeah.
And there's this book, Peter Attia in Outlive. He's very focused on muscle mass. And it seems kind of counterintuitive to think that like if you want to preserve muscle mass, like eat a ton of protein. Like that in itself logically didn't make sense to me. Mm. And your book kind of addressed this, right? So you actually advise protein restriction in older age. Can we talk about what protein restriction means for muscle mass retention in old age?
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, maintaining muscle mass is critically important, right, for preventing falls, for, you know, maintaining one's mobility. But the way we do that is not through eating extra protein. The way we do that is through physical activity, is resistance exercise, is by weights, by balance training, by all that. And so there really is no, people want some like quick fix, silver bullet, shortcut kind of thing. I don't want to work out. I just, you know, want to, you know, take some supplement and, you know. And unfortunately, it's, yeah, that's just not how the body works. When it comes to protein and aging, you know, less really may be more. Reducing protein intake, meaning restricting protein intake down to the recommended levels, this is the only thing I could find that could help block all 11 of the aging pathway. So it boosts NAD, improves immunity, decreases oxidative stress, inflammation, insulin resistance, as well as the cancer-promoting growth hormone IGF-1. And, you know, to my surprise, so I thought going into this, we would basically have to do this kind of balance beam between longevity and muscle mass, but surprisingly, no benefit. Adding extra protein to the diets of older men and women in terms of muscle mass, muscle strength, or physical performance. Instead, what happens is the excess protein that most Americans eat causes a drop in the pro-longevity hormone FGF21, a drop in testosterone, a worsening of the age-accelerating enzyme mTOR. So we should strive to stick to the recommended level of intake, which is 0.8 grams per healthy kilogram body weight, which comes out to be about 45 grams a day for the average height woman, 55 grams for the average height man.
Wow. That's really helpful. And you know, there's a documentary called Game Changers, which I think advised on, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, fantastic.
One of my favorite documentaries. And in there, the strongest man in the world is a vegan, right? And he's, you know, he talks about this time when he was interviewed and he was asked, how can you be as strong as an ox if you don't eat meat? And he looks at him deadpan. He's like, when was the last time you saw an ox eating meat?
Exactly. You know? Right.
And it just makes sense because, like, if it just is asinine to think that in order to get protein, you need to eat animals when most of the animals who are, you know, out there, many of the animals we eat, they're eating plants. They're not eating other animals.
In fact, yeah. So that's where all, so the reason we need protein is because we need these essential amino acids. And the reason we call them essential is because as animals, we can't make them.
Right.
We have to get them into our diet. So that's why they're essential in our diet. Well, guess what? The animals we eat are animals too. They can't make them either.
Yeah.
All essential amino acids come from the ground.
Right.
They come from plants and microorganisms. And so we just kind of cut out the middleman by, you know, getting essential amino acids directly. All plants have all essential amino acids. There's really only one protein in the food supply that's incomplete, meaning lacking in essential amino acids. That's collagen or gelatin.
Yeah.
So because it lacks tryptophan, you could literally die if all you ate was Jell-O. Or you'd die of protein deficiency because you're missing that one amino acid. But all plant proteins have all the essential amino acids. It's really about not getting too much protein when it comes to the anti-aging literature.
Makes sense. Another thing that a lot of my friends, when I interviewed them, said was, well, isn't age just really dominantly dictated by my parents and my genes?
Yeah.
And in your book, you talk about stress, you talk about the genetic weight in the aging equation, and yet it seems your behavior and lifestyle choices still are the dominant factor. Can you talk about why and what's going on in this cocktail?
Yeah, so we have studies done on identical twins that found that only about 25% of the variation in lifespan between individuals has to do with genetics. And so the question is, okay, what can we do over the vast majority of which we may have control? And so that's where diet comes in as the predominant factor, but other things are important. I talk about sleep, stress, weight control, exercise, smoking cessation, on down the list. But, you know, I think one of the main takeaways from the book is that, you know, we have, it's really this good news that we have tremendous power over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a healthy enough diet and lifestyle. And it doesn't take much. It's not black and white. You know, it doesn't require drastic changes. Even just the basic common sense lifestyle factors can mean living literally a decade longer, not smoking, not being obese, regular exercise, eating more fruits and vegetables. It's really the basics that get you most of the way there. And then, yes, you know, if you want to, you know, really push it to the edge and maximize everything, well, then I got tons of recommendations. But I don't want people to lose sight of really some of the core basics, which are really the foundational in terms of living a long, healthy life.
Yeah, you know, one thing, one of your quotes, I'm not sure if it was in the book or in one of your interviews after that I watched, but you said, genes load the gun, but your lifestyle pulls the trigger.
Yeah.
That to me was very telling of what's going on here. It's like, yeah, you're given a deck of cards, but how you play that hand in the game is really what matters, right?
Exactly, right. So if you think about it, not every smoker dies from lung cancer. So you say, wait a second, if smoking causes lung cancer, why doesn't everybody die? Because people have different genetics. Some people are more susceptible to getting lung cancer from smoking than other people.
Mm-hmm.
But just because there's an obvious genetic component doesn't mean we shouldn't stop smoking, right? I mean, it means that, oh my God, well, for some people, it's even more important than for another person to stop smoking. But it's important for everybody because you don't know if you're the type of person that's going to die from lung cancer if you smoke or not. So really the best thing we can do is, not start to happen in the first place. But, you know, these aren't guarantees. You know, it's just like, why do we buckle our seatbelt? We don't buckle our seatbelt because we're guaranteed not to die in a car crash if we do that. No, it's just we have good data suggesting that it significantly decreases your risk.
Yeah.
Right? And since it's, it doesn't take a lot of time. Okay. Risk, the benefits outweigh any potential risk. And so the same thing with, healthy eating and living. It's not guaranteed you're not going to get some horrible disease. I talk about some of the famous longevity researcher. Poor dude got ALS, right?
No,
wrote a
man.
Book like Living to be 120 or whatever. Then the dude died in his 70s from ALS. Oh, wow, that sucks. Now, maybe if he hadn't gotten ALS, he would have done really good. He had all these great ideas. But, it's like, look, we're all playing the odds and we're doing the best with the available information.
Yeah.
And some things are so easy or even delicious to do, to incorporate into our life. There's really no downside. So I think we should give it a try.
Absolutely. I mean, just a quick things that I want to throw out so listeners can check it out. You have an amazing discussion on autophagy, on spermidines, simple things like wheat germ. That's an incredible wheat germ, flax, berries, and greens. I was amazed. Oh. The importance of just leafy greens.
Popeye was right. I'm telling you. No, in fact, the nitrates actually boost muscle performance. Greens. That's the one food I think came up over. It comes up in the vision chapter. It comes up in the brain chapter. Yeah.
Do you find that people, as you go on this book tour and you're promoting these ideas, are families who have older folks who've been stricken with these diseases, are they resistant to your information? Because I just noticed that when it comes to cancer and Alzheimer's in particular, we have this, like, I hate to call it a delusion, but no one wants to accept that it isn't random.
Right. Right?
It's like no one wants to say that I had a role in this outcome.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, how have families reacted to this?
Yeah, that's really the flip side. So, I mean, there's this fantastic news. We have tremendous power of whether or not we're going to get cancer or not, right? So that's fantastic news, unless you have cancer, in which case it's like, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
Then it's like, oh, people are like blameworthy, right?
Yeah.
It's like maybe you didn't necessarily have to get cancer. And so then they're like beating themselves up. And so look, I don't want people to beat themselves up, but I do want to share that good news that we really do have tremendous power. But look, even if by tremendous power, we mean dropping risk, 85%, for example, right?
Yeah.
So someone eating a really clean diet has about 85% less chance of getting type 2 diabetes, for example. Oh my God, that's great, right? Vast majority of risk throw out the window. But wait a second, 15% of the risk? I mean, diabetes is a total epidemic. Having 15%, that means there's a lot of people eating healthy with type 2 diabetes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's still these elements of other factors that go into it. And so all we can do is try our best.
Yeah.
And we can try to do it as early as possible in life. But even we have studies showing even people in the 80s have years on the table just by choosing these simple common sense, healthy lifestyle behaviors. And so it's never too late to start eating healthier, never too late to start moving, never too late to stop smoking. We really do have the power here.
Yeah. And I mean, even in your book, you do cite evidence where people as late in their 60s and 80s making adjustments into their diet can actually add years to their life. It's incredible.
Amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. Right? So that's great.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I mean, right. But it's the people that start like age 20, whoa, Dan, they really have literally decades on the table. So that, I mean, that's super exciting.
Yeah, honestly, so I became a dad, you know, 2.5 years ago. And and now I have two daughters.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
I legit, you know, tell people, like, my ambition is to be a centenarian and see my great grandkids. Like, and
there we go.
I actually feel like I can do that. I don't think that's ridiculous.
No, it's great. Right. Right. And it's like, yeah, I mean, regardless of what you want to do in life, right, you need your health. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So it's like, I mean, that's often how I would, you know, phrase it to patients. It's just like, well, you tell me what your goals in life are. Like, what do you want to be doing in X many years? Right. Because I know it's kind of a sneaky way to do it. Because I know whatever they say, unless they're like, oh, I want to be gorked out as a vegetable in a hospital somewhere.
Exactly.
Okay. Basically, anything they want to do, want to travel the world, want to, you know, well, you need your health. And so then I'm like, okay, look, you said it, not me. These are your goals. Okay. And so I'm going to tell you how you're going to achieve your goals. This is how you should eat. This is how, you know, if you want to do that. Now, look, if your goals change, then okay, we can revisit. But, you know, I mean, I think that's a helpful kind of framing, because it's not like I don't want people to be healthy just for health's sake.
Yeah.
Health enables you to enjoy life and to do what you want to do in your life. I mean, anyone who's been in chronic pain or known someone in chronic pain or, you know, as a physician, you know, you see people in the hospital. I mean, people don't understand how debilitating, how, I mean, think about having like a bad cold. Everyone's had a bad cold, right? Think how miserable you are. You can't sleep. You're all clogged up. Okay. That's a freaking cold. That's like the least thing you can get affected by.
Not even
right?
cold. I got my COVID vaccine booster or whatever yesterday. I was out like a baby. I was like, no, I can't do anything. I was such a wreck.
Right. Well, the reason you're such a wreck is because you have such a powerful immune system, right? Really ramped up. I mean, that's really a sign that your body was like, all right, let's kick some ass.
I hope so. Okay. Speaking of kicking ass. The hardest, okay, so I have incorporated a lot, like, it's incredible to meet an author, and I'm sure you hear this all the time, but, like, you have changed my life, right?
Awesome.
And I have a podcast where I talk to authors, and I read 50 to 70 books a year, and there's no author who's actually impacted my life more than you.
Awesome.
And I've done pretty much everything. The hardest thing that I had to do, and the hardest thing I think a lot of my listeners and my fans found was how to give up alcohol and sobriety. And, you know, alcohol plays this like cultural phenomenon. We celebrate with it. But like in some of your talks and as you go out, you're like, the level of safe alcohol is actually zero.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about why? And I'm just curious, you know, how you have dealt with this or how you have, you know,
huge social component. There's also a genetic component to alcoholism in terms of alcohol dependence. But yeah, you know, look, everybody, we've always known that heavy drinking, drinking during pregnancy and binge drinking had been bad for us. But there was this concept that that moderate drinking was okay, right? I mean, that's what we used to think.
A glass of red wine for the antioxidants.
Exactly. Right. Those who lived the longest were not the abstainers, those who drank zero alcohol, but those who imbibed through a few drinks a week. Unfortunately, this appears to be an artifact we now know of what's called the sick quitter effect, which comes from this systematic misclassification as former drinkers as if they were lifelong abstainers. And so the reason they're drinking is not because they always haven't drunk, but because they got sick. The same reason why, you know, studies found that higher mortality rates among those who quit smoking compared to those who continue. It's not that abstinence led to a poor health, but rather poor health led to abstinence. And so if you go back and you correct for that misclassification, you actually compare people who don't drink because they haven't ever drank versus those who drink even light or moderate. You realize that, you know, according to the Global Burden of Disease Study, the World Health Organization, the World Heart Federation, safest level of drinking really is none, because alcohol produces a carcinogen called acetaldehyde in the body, second leading cause of death. And so, you know, grapes, barley, and potatoes are best eaten in their non-distilled form. And Johnny Walker is no substitute for actual
Walker, right? Hey, can I tell you something? When I look at the deterioration of the blue zones, it's very interesting that the Loma Linda in California, and, you know, for listeners who haven't seen the Blue Zones documentary, it's about seven areas with the highest rates of centenarians per capita. And Loma Linda, California is like the only one that has not been consumed by sort of the westernization of the American diet. Yeah. I don't think it's just a coincidence that they're also the ones that by religion are sober.
Yeah, you know, don't have the drinking. Exactly. Although it's interesting, I don't know if you saw that series, that Singapore is trying to get in on the action with the Blue Zones. I didn't realize. So Singapore did actually exceed for the first time Japan as the country with the longest life expectancy.
Unreal.
And so that's really cool. And so it just suggests that, you know, you can make these easy, you know, make basically the healthy option the default option. You know, you can do a lot from a policy perspective to make a population healthier.
Absolutely. Another question that my listeners had for you was, do we know anything now about, let's say, marijuana consumption, psychedelics when it comes to aging?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I did a whole series on cannabis and talked about the pros and cons. Basically, it made everybody upset. It was like way safer than the naysayers, you know, and then way less effective at treating all sorts of conditions than the pot lovers. And so basically everyone came off pissed. But there are some genuine things that help with. Ironically, it's not the things you hear about, like glaucoma and things. And there are certainly some downsides, really, for heavy pot smokers can run to some lung problems. But for people who are interested, they can go to that series. And psychedelics is next. I actually just went through the literature. I was shocked that there are literally thousands of papers out there now in the human medical literature on psychedelics. It's just been this renaissance. And the reason I haven't done any videos on it is just because there wasn't any science, because it was banned, basically. So science basically, you know, kind of ground to a halt in this area. If there's no science, what are you going to, you know, all you have is kind of anecdote. But now all of a sudden there's this whole revolution now, particularly as big pharma is getting involved and trying to come up with their own little psychedelics so they can make some money off of it. But I mean, the positive side of that is they're pumping a lot of money into the field. And so we're actually getting some decent research. You know, one of the problems I ran into trying to decipher that literature is that it's really hard to, you know, what do you do for the placebo effect, right? I mean, you kind of know if you're on psychedelics or not, right? And so let's say psychedelics work for depression or whatever, particular psychedelic, particular dose works for that. What do you use for a placebo, right? Because you're going to know which group you're in. So you got to have this placebo effect of this altered experience. So interesting what they did.
Maybe like a psilocybin mushroom with a portobello mushroom. Just throwing that out there.
But you feel it. That's the problem. So at first they gave people drugs that give you weird side effects, like make your mouth really dry. And then people think like, oh, I must be on the good stuff, right? I'm not in the placebo group. Like I'm actually something actively happening to me. So that can get some of the, but it's not like you're going to see God, you know, with a dry mouth. So the most interesting experiments I found were those that where you put people under general anesthesia. Then you give them mushrooms.
Wow.
Then you keep them under general anesthesia till the trip's over. You wake them up and they have no idea whether they had a trip or not, because they were completely under, right? Then you see, does it help for depression? Then you see, does it help for X, Y, and Z? Fascinating, right? Is it just the subjective experience, or is there something biologically going on? Anyway, still working through this literature. Going to have a whole long series about it. I'll probably do a webinar about it. Super exciting area of research. Not all benign. There's some neurotoxicity with MDMA, for example. But I'll cover it all. Stay tuned.
How not to groove? To trip?
How
not to trip? I can't wait to take a look at that content.
It'll be interesting. I found it really fascinating and way more. I mean, I was just blown away by how much was out there. And so now I'm like, shit, I'm like way behind now. I gotta catch up.
And I tell you, you know, I'm not actually very shy about telling people that I actually took some, I had a, what I would call a spiritual, not a recreational, but a spiritual experience with psychedelics right around the time that I was making a lot of these health changes. I was just in a bad space. And I got to tell you, my level of like commitment and willpower, and it helped me just kind of solidify my you know, my drive. And cool. I think it helped a lot of these things stick. Because think about it, like the alcohol and the culture around meat and everything, like a lot of these are externally imposed values.
That's true.
And psychedelics like really helped me say like, none of that matters. I want to get in touch with myself.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Hey, anything that gets people to make it easier to make the healthy option, well, then, you know, what else do you need?
Yeah, right. You know, I wanted to.
So we got to put it in the water supply or what? Come on.
I know, right? Jesus, we are going to be the most unproductive society in the world.
We're going to be healthy.
We're going to be healthy. We're going to last forever, though. Let's talk about dignity. The whole inspiration with your grandmother passing, everything. I'm just curious, like, you know, what does it mean for you to die in dignity? Die with dignity.
Yeah, no, I did a whole chapter on that. I thought that was really important. And I talk about some of the ways out, some of the ways to have control, and kind of the pros and cons. You know, if you are not living in a state that has something like physician-assisted dying, and even then, you know, there are some barriers to it. So, in fact, I have a series of videos just went up on nutritionfacts.org talking about VSED, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, and what that would mean in terms of ending your own life. I think most people who saw that series really take it away as being empowering, feeling like, oh, okay, I don't have to rely on anybody else to kind of take my life in my own hands. And that's a big part of dignity and dying, is having that sense of control and not having to cede that control.
Thank you for what you do, Dr. Greger. You're changing lives. We really appreciate you.
Keep up the great work.
Take care, sir.
At this point in life, I think back over my life and I think how lucky I was to live the life I lived.
This is my neighbor, Roy Langdell. He's 90 years old, and he is my role model. He is my hero. He is on the trail just as much as the youngest guys in the community. He's smiling. He's vibrant. He exudes and glows positive energy. He has wonderful relationships with his children, his grandchildren, and he's even expecting a bundle of great-grandchildren here in the near future. And I wanted to sit down with him to understand what aging with dignity and happiness really looks like.
You depend a lot on luck, but the harder you work at it, the luckier you get.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing, as I look back over my life, is who you pick as a life partner. Because you're going to spend, during your working years, you're going to spend over half your time with them. And then when you retire, it'll be all the time. And I was very fortunate. I had 60 years of a good marriage. I don't think you weren't here. You never met my wife, I don't think, before.
No,
because she passed away about a year and a half ago, but there was about 4 years before that she had had a stroke, and she had onset dementia, and I had to have her at the Arbors, and I'd go in every morning.
Yeah.
But we had a great 60 years of life. And
what was your name?
Mary Lou.
Mary Lou, what a beautiful name. So I got to ask, how did you and Mary Lou meet?
Well, we met in college. It was after my freshman year. I was taking civil engineering, and in civil engineering, between your freshman and your sophomore year, you have to take the surveying, 6-week surveying course at the university. And she was in nursing school at the university, and you have a lot of evenings free during that period of time. And we met there, and we never were separated after that.
What a beautiful story. And how many kids did you guys have together?
Three children.
Wow.
And they each, we have 6 grandchildren.
Goodness.
And they're all living very happy lives. I don't have a single family member that has given me any trouble.
And ain't that something that's rare? Like,
yeah. Most families have somebody there that's having a problem.
Yeah. I mean, first off, I think it's cool that I ask you one of the keys to your long and happy, successful life, and the first thing out of your mouth was choosing the right life partner. I think that's absolutely brilliant. It wasn't something rooted in diet, exercise, or some magic formula. It was, you had a really warm and loving home. And even in your body language, I can see it. She still to this day holds a very deep place in your heart. And of course, from that loving home came three really well-adjusted, good citizens, good children who are themselves raising good grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I mean, it makes so much sense. And I think day to day, like, there is no one in the world who has more of a weight on my morale than my wife. You know, when she and I are doing good, which is, you know, 90% of the time, 95% of the time, then everything else is, even the darkest challenges are achievable and surmountable. Whereas, you know, when we're in a fight or, you know, just going through some rough patches ourselves, like any couple, everything else feels heavier. So I'm just curious, what, you and your wife, when you met, did you have similar interests? Were you leading similar lifestyles?
I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't. She was not interested in exactly the same things I was, but she had hobbies that she did, yeah, and that type of thing, and friends and what have you. But she grew up in Long Island, and her father was a Presbyterian minister.
Oh, wow.
So that's a little different, where I grew up in the hills of Vermont, and quite a lot of difference.
Yeah. Right on, man. Just curious, how about your parents? I'm getting, you know, how much of your longevity is also rooted in your genetic makeup? Were your parents able to live really long, healthy lives as well?
My mother lived to be 94, so she was living good long. My father, he died at 56.
Oh,
he had pancreatic cancer or something like that. So he died young, but my mother lived, and her family seemed to have a long life. She had with two sisters that all lived in their 90s, and she had a brother who lived in every year of the 1900s. I mean, he was born in 1900 and died in 1999, so
wow,
he lived to be 100.
That's amazing.
Well, that is really special, Roy. I want to go back to your wife a bit because, you know, part of the reason we're doing this episode is Dr. Greger's book, How Not to Age. And a big part of that is, of course, diet. And I want to start talking about the things you eat. And I know you're an avid gardener. You almost sustain your entire diet from your garden in the summer. It's incredible. But first off, when, like you said, your marriage partner, your life partner is the most important choice you make. Something that I think we don't always think about is that person also dictates your diet. Right? It's really hard to live with someone who's got a different set of diet goals and ideas about what a healthy diet is. And so, for example, I have friends that have tried to go on a plant-based diet, but their spouses want to continue eating meat, and they're doing separate grocery lists, separate meals. It's hard to eat together as a family. And so before we get into what your diet has been throughout your life, I'm curious, did you influence your wife's diet, or did your wife actually influence your diet?
We're always both on the same page. It seemed like we went through life and we just never had anything to argue about. It seemed like I can't remember having a serious argument.
Well, you know what I'm sensing here, Roy, is maybe a degree of a selective memory there, right? Another
maybe I'm forgetting all those. That's one of the joys of being 90. You forget most of the you forget all the bad stuff. Yeah, all the negative stuff. Yeah,
that's a great way to live.
So, what did a typical dinner plate or lunch plate look like for you over the course of your life, Roy? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I always have the same breakfast. I have a cereal, which I put four almonds on and four walnuts and a teaspoon of Metamucil and a fruit such as a banana or frozen berries on top. And nice. then I put orange juice on instead of milk. I don't drink milk.
So no dairy.
No dairy.
Yeah, and berries.
Yeah.
And a banana.
And
do you drink coffee and tea in the morning?
Yes, and then coffee. Yeah, nice. I have coffee with that. And then at lunch, my typical lunch is in the summertime, I always have some vegetables out of the garden. I always have vegetables.
And we're definitely going to revisit gardening.
Yeah.
This
okay.
Conversation.
Yeah.
I think it's such an important part of your story. Yeah.
And I do have quite a lot of. I mean, I have salmon and sea bass steaks and stuff like that. I quite often have that. And I have my big meal at noon.
Nice.
And that's that. And then I don't have a lot at night.
Got it.
Yeah. So it's really and it's the same every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except when I have the gang down on Saturday, and then I cook something.
Your family barbecue.
We have barbecue. And I do sometimes have, in the wintertime, I quite often do a slow cook pot, you know, the pot of beef and all the vegetables in it, and I cook it for 8 hours. So I started at 4 o'clock in the morning. And,
8 hours.
Yeah,
that's pretty awesome, Roy. Got a question. What about alcohol? Do you drink frequently or not?
I have a glass of wine, usually with my midday meal, but that's all the wine. That's all that. I don't drink any liquor and. And I might on a weekend if my son-in-law's here and he has a beer, I might have a beer with him. But I'm really, alcohol is not a big part of it. Except that I do like the red wine with my midday meal.
Glass of wine and midday lunch. I love that.
So that goes pretty good.
So a couple of themes I'm picking up on, Roy. One I'm noticing is your diet is very light in dairy. I didn't hear a ton of cheese or a ton of ice cream.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I do have, quite often at night, I may have a little bit of cheese with that. Right.
Yeah, but, still pretty moderate, it sounds like. You know, the other thing, Roy, I'm noticing is, like, I think there's something to be said about the time-restricted nature of your eating. Like, you're not eating this, like, ginormous dinner, right?
Midday rather than at night. Rather than eating the big meal just before you go to bed, I think is a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And, not only what you just told us, but just knowing you personally, what I know is a big part of your diet are the vegetables from your garden.
I eat a lot of vegetables. I have my garden and I always have a lot of, I have the lettuce and that type of stuff, but I also have beans, which I plant about every 2 or 3 weeks. I plant a little 4-foot row, and so I have them all summer and way into the fall, the string beans.
And you know what my favorite is? And the best part of being your neighbor, Roy, is getting your leftovers.
Oh.
Like when you have a harvest and you just got too much squash.
Right.
Too much mescaline.
Yeah.
You know, you'll drive on over, drop off a bag of apples from the apple tree, tomatoes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Vermont here, Roy, is that everybody has a garden.
Yeah.
You know?
And what I love about that is, in different parts of the country, you know, people look at you, judge you. Oh, what kind of car are they driving? What kind of golf clubs does that guy have? Here in Vermont, it's like, what's in your garden, bro? What are you growing? We got beans. You got squash. What you growing? That's how we judge each other in Vermont. Your garden is massive. Do you know how big it is? Like what the dimensions are?
Oh, it isn't that large. It's a little bigger than this room. I would say it's probably 20, 25 by 20.
Yeah, 25 by 20 is a huge garden. And what's most impressive to me is you manage it all yourself.
Yeah, I got my own little rototiller that I can chew it up with. But I find that I don't hire anything done, really. I just find that at this point in life, if I didn't do all these things, I wouldn't get my exercise. And so I find it like I do my own yard. I blow my own snow out of my yard.
So you're doing your own snow removal.
Yeah, snow removal.
Doing your own gardening.
Yeah, and mowing the lawn.
And mowing your own lawn.
Yeah. So I do most everything there.
Clean your own house.
Yeah, and I've actually made almost all of the wood furniture in the house. There's very little that I didn't make out in my barn.
Wow.
I mean. But that was mainly after I retired and had all this time on my hands.
Now, with all this time on your hands, got to ask you, we're 99 pages. We're a podcast about books. Are you a big reader? Do you read a lot?
Yeah, I read quite a lot now. Now, because when you get to be my age, you forget everything. And so I've got about 35 or 40 books on my Kindle. Now, I can go back and read the old ones, and I can't remember anything. I'm reading one that I've read before.
Wow. That's great.
But I have one book which I have read, I've read three or four times, and I've got to read it again.
That's so wonderful. You just kind of relive the excitement over and over again. I want to take a moment and kind of crystallize some of the lessons here that I've learned from you, Roy. One, a diet rich in vegetables. A diet that is, you know, you do choose to eat meat, but it also does sound pretty moderate. And it does seem clear that you've got limited dairy, moderate alcohol. But I think something that's super interesting is just like the level of self-reliance you've built into your life. Like you mow your own lawn, you clean your own house, you till your own garden, you snow blow your own driveway in the winter, you even build your own furniture. There's clearly a sense of duty and purpose that comes with these behaviors and habits and this, you know, this will to do everything yourself. I think there's something really powerful in that. And then, of course, I think, as you said, let's reiterate, the most important thing is you chose the right life partner. And I think that no doubt has been critical for your success. I want to sort of get your take on the nature of life in 2023, the year today. You've seen many decades. I think you bought your house when Nixon was president. like when you see modern life today, what are the things that give you pause, that you worry about for your grandchildren and great-grandchildren and their ability to lead a similar long and healthy life like you have done?
Well, I know I'm very discouraged. I spend too much time listening to the news.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That'll give you some stress.
and I do find it seems like that at the present time we have less good choices in politicians than we used to have in either party.
Yeah. Right?
That gives me pause a little bit. It seems like when I was growing up, there was always some statesman-like people that people looked up to because they were looking out for the best of the country. And I just don't see much of that today.
I would expand that beyond just politics. And I would actually assert that we just don't have very many good role models today.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Who did you look up to when you were younger? Who were your role models?
Well, I had a professor at UVM that I ended up going into business with, and he was a good role model. Steve Knight, his name was. And Steve called me up and said, why don't we start a structural engineering firm?
Wow.
Yeah, I was within a week of taking the job, which would have changed my whole life. I would have not been here. I would have been off down in the... And so there's a lot of luck in there.
Yeah. And, I know a lot about your company just through our conversations, a really successful engineering firm here in the Vermont Burlington area that over the past few decades has, you know, helped facilitate a lot of the buildings in town. And I know, your business is kind of winding down and so on. But, you know, you saw absolutely a lot of growth here in this state. And I'm curious, did you ever experience work stress? Like, how did you deal with being an entrepreneur and managing the stress and making sure it didn't come home to you?
I don't think I did. It seems like I went through my whole life and didn't really experience a terrible lot of stress.
Roy, that's an impressive reaction. And I mean, look, having been an entrepreneur myself, that's a stressful position to be in. I am just so curious, how, even when starting a company, did you manage to avoid stress?
Well, the main thing was we came in at a time when the area needed what we were providing, and there weren't any other structural engineering consulting firms in the area. None, really. We built up a firm. We probably had about 25 people in the firm.
That's incredible.
Right? And But we did structural design. We had a testing lab where we did the testing, construction testing, like concrete cylinders. You know, when they build big buildings, and you take concrete cylinders out of every batch you pour, and you have to break them. And
all right. So, like, what I'm getting the sense of is, okay, there was plenty of opportunity, Roy. But still, you were running a business. I mean, that if there's plenty of opportunity, you were never struggling for contracts, but you still had to go hire talent. You had to go recruit people, maybe even raise capital.
Work longer hours.
Work longer hours.
Yeah. I mean, you're working a long hours. Like, this is, just because there's opportunity doesn't mean there wasn't stress or opportunities to be stressed. So when you think about why you were able to keep your work life and your home life from sort of bleeding into each other from a stress perspective. How did you manage that?
Well, one of the things was that having this partner, this Steve Knight, who was a very intelligent guy, that whenever I had problems that I had somebody to turn to and run it by him to make sure that I was doing it right. And I think that took a lot of the stress off just because I had somebody very intelligent that I was working with.
So in addition to having a wonderful partner at home and Mary Lou, you had a wonderful partner at work.
Right. And I could see without that, it would be stressful if you were concerned about, did I do this problem right, you know, because it would result in building falling down. And so it was really helpful to have. So again, I was lucky. I think it was a lot of it's just plain luck.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely luck involved, Roy. But you know, as we're talking, I'm uncovering moments of genius. And one thing I'm picking up here now is, you know, between Mary Lou, your wife, and Steve, your partner, you have built up a skill in being a good partner, either professional or personal life partner. So Roy, let me ask you this. What does it take? What does it mean to you to be a good partner?
Jeez, I don't know.
You just sort of got
lucky
on that one too.
I got lucky on that one too. But you got to be honest with the person and so that people trust you and they know how you're going to react to all the problems in it.
Yeah, I think that's really wise. And I'm also getting the sense of, in addition to earning trust and feeling trusted and making that reciprocal, both Mary Lou and Steve probably also felt a degree of your commitment, right? They knew you were in it for the long haul. Something that I think that interferes with commitment and the notion of commitment in our modern generation is actually our constant obsession and interaction with technology, because commitment is weakened in many ways by optionality. And whether it's your job or your dating life, like you are just a swipe away from the worldwide options of new partners, either professional or personal. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about, especially as a parent myself, is putting away the devices and what that might mean for the structure of one's commitment to either the task or people at hand. And so I wanted to ask you, Roy, what is your relationship like with technology, either your laptop, a computer, tablet? I see you have a phone, like what apps are on your phone. Curious what your relationship with technology is like.
There was a time when the computer first came out, I was top of my game because I was writing programs. It was when you had a computer, but they weren't programs available for the type of structural problems I was doing, and you wrote your own programs. And so I went through that first phase, and then I was pretty good at it. But then now, I mean, I don't even like the phone that I have. I care it. I mean, I like the old flip phone that I had. That was just a phone. That didn't do anything else, but it was a phone.
I'm just curious, Roy. What apps do you have on your phone? What do you use on a what takes up your time on your phone?
I try not to look at it very much. I look at the weather and what do I look at? They're in a lock that I look at.
You have a very simple device. Now, do you have photos of your family?
Oh, yes, I have a lot.
Can I see a photo of your family? Let's see. All right. That looks like a good family photo.
Yeah. I don't really do a lot of that. The kids do. I get more from the gang and all of the... that's some of the gang there.
So who am I looking at here?
Well, these are my my grandson and his wife and another grandson and his wife. Wow. And this one here, they are not married yet, but they will be soon.
And one of those is
they're all cousins. Yeah, one is my granddaughter. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're so happy.
Oh, they are. They're all, there isn't any tension in the family anywhere, the whole family.
None at all?
None at all, no. I have one granddaughter that is gay, but there isn't any. Everybody accepts it.
That's great.
But they all like to come visit, and we all have a good time.
Was it difficult for you to learn that your granddaughter was homosexual? Or
not really.
You accepted it off the bat. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, everybody should live their own life, however they want to.
You know, I also don't take that for granted, Roy, that someone of your generation feels that way. I think that there were a lot of people who were not as open-minded. So kudos to you for being ahead of the times. So, you know, we're getting towards the end of our time here, Roy. And so I've picked up a lot of wisdom from our conversation, everything from the nature of your diet, your just the ownership with which you take your life. I mean, you know, putting your hands on every single task that needs to get done and not hiring it out. Roy, it's just an honor to be your neighbor. And I just cannot convey in words what it means to have a symbol of what a good life looks like living next door to me. And so thank you. All I can say is thank you and just grateful to be your friend and neighbor.
Thanks again.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Awesome. I love that.
Well, that was our show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, would you consider please rating us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Those ratings help us out a ton. Also, consider going to 99pages.club, C-L-U-B, and joining our email list. Each month, I send out just two emails, one promoting our most recent podcast interview, but a second with some book recommendations for your nonfiction reading list. So far, the reviews have been really great. People like getting those unique reads on their list that they otherwise would not have found. So that's 99pages.club, C-L-U-B. Thanks, and we will be back very soon.